From Longreads, Was It Worth It? Adam Dalva Longreads, April 29, 2026, 2084 words, 9 minutes. This essay, from Steak Scene, is co-published with Cake Scene. Every Sunday evening, I open the fridge, reach into the vegetable crisper, grab a pen, screw in a needle, pinch my stomach, and inject Ozempic. It hurts a bit, but I've gotten used to it. 25 pounds down, 20 to go. I put on the weight after my brother died. The distortion in the mirror, random heavy breathing, strange hunger panics around 4 p.m. The constant need to self-soothe, and I wanted to let go, move on, heal. That's one rendition of truth, the one I wish I could sell you. Claiming I'm injecting to recover from grief deflects simple humiliation into potential empathy, rendering me unmockable for taking a medication that I've seen called easy mode and stolen valor online, a workaround for people lacking the willpower to lose weight the old-fashioned way. Really, though, my bereavement was internal and external justification for something I would have wanted to try anyway. I've trended toward heaviness my entire life, and food has always been a font of shame. When I eat in public, when I order in restaurants, I feel overly visible, fearing that every bite could contribute to the perception that I lack self-control. And so I sneak food. Mine is the panicked late-night nibble, then the easing of the fridge door closed. The man who prescribed my Ozempic is a plastic surgeon who didn't even performatively gesture at weighing me. But he did tap my left temple, contemplate my receding hairline, and say, "You'll be wanting minoxidil too, I expect." Then he gazed at my forehead wrinkles evaluatively, forensically, active. Aiding spasms of dysmorphia hitherto unknown. Mine is rearranging the contents of the garbage can to conceal wrappers and cores. It had been unclear to me, pre-GLP-1, how to write without something salty or sleep without something sweet. And the theory that the medication might quiet food noise particularly appealed to me. A week later, at a mediocre bar, my friends ordered nachos. They picked, I picked, matching their cadence of nibbles to avoid drawing attention to myself. Soon the chips were half done, and my friends expressed their fullness with the satiated calm of the thin, and the cheese and the steak had congealed together, and, reader, I didn't think about those nachos even once. I had never experienced anything like it. Is this, I asked my friends, how it feels to be normal. 8 months later, the noise is still muted. At parties where I once would have conducted a hasty maneuver toward the finger foods, I chat with friends instead. I have lost what little interest I had in alcohol. A few weeks after I began injecting myself, in a period when I was eating very little and mostly bland food when I did, a temporary diet of crackers and roast chicken, with gastrointestinal side effects too gnarly for even a habitually oversharing personal essayist to impart, I noted that I had been preoccupied with YouTube shorts of people reviewing food. I suspect Ozempic has cured my seasonal affective disorder too. In past years, I'd get hungry at dusk in November, throwing off my circadian rhythm. But in the absence of that need, no depression has hit. I'd watch video after video of influencers trying various dishes, often while sitting in their cars while cheery voiceovers played. In my strange absence of flavor, their glossy enthusiasm was captivating. I suspect that I was outsourcing my own eating. These days, I once again enjoy the taste of food. The medication works well, save for one unfortunate side effect. I'm still obsessed with those eating videos. I've learned that each of the influencers has a gimmick. Yue Eats, a pseudo-everman who's overly obsessed with meat char. Caitlin Lavery, a peppy New Yorker with an unfathomable dining budget. Jack's Dining Room, a loathsome industry plant. Shofo Cho, who weighs food to assess value. Carissa Eats, a disnified culinary optimist. I've watched thousands of them. I'm frightened to know the real number, and sometimes I think I've actually reached the bottom of YouTube, when I'm served videos made by people with no followers and one view, just mine. These content creators' occasional mukbangs and habitual asthma crinkling of chip bags do nothing much for me. No, my interest is most piqued by the shorts in which they review all-you-can-eat restaurants and ask, "Did I beat the buffet?" Did they, in other words, get beyond their money's worth? There's a scarcity mindset in this moment of late-stage capitalism, which is understandable. Times are hard. But the min-slash-maxing strategies that ignore gastronomical pleasure in favor of eating oneself sick alarm and titillate me in equal measure, in this time where pleasure itself feels more and more difficult to access. Take the many reviews of Fogo de Queijo, the relatively upscale Brazilian all-you-can-eat steak restaurant. Don't waste time. Every reviewer cautions on delicious starch, on the buffet's greens, on sweets, on poultry, on cheese with honey. Maximize cow, beef rib, picanha. Joe Rogan has raved about the salad bar's sironic temptations on his interminable podcast, and you're eating fucking artichoke hearts and cheese. YouTuber UA Eats's face contorts into a pained bliss reminiscent of Peter Huejar's 1969 orgasmic man photo when he tries the fatty ribeye. Even sans Özbek, I have never been a big block of meat eater. I think of Passover pot roasts with some horror, find hot poultry uninteresting, believe that pork chops are odious, and have written off lamb legs as habitually gamey. But still, I developed the fantasy of going to Fogo de Queijo myself. My desire was mimetic. I had seen so many of these videos that I wanted to participate in one, wanted to see if I could experience the hypothetical pleasure of beating the buffet. Fogo was especially captivating for another reason. I have a vague memory, decades ago, perhaps in Philadelphia, of going to a Fogo de Queijo. All I really know is that I was young. I think I went with my first ever girlfriend. I remember marveling at the abundance, the new flavors. I'd laugh when I ate, back then, dumb phone in my pocket. All that future ahead, the restaurant filled with sun, was that cell forever lost to grief and medication and plain old time? And so one evening earlier this year, I drank a cup of tea and ate a mid-sized Honeycrisp with a swipe of peanut butter to preserve my stomach. The next morning, I headed off to my studio space to write until my reservation. My neighbor, a jeweler, said that she had made an extra chicken katsu sando and asked if I wanted it. I replied that I did want it but was starving myself to go to a buffet. Off my sando went into the ether. That night, I passed laughing tourists taking pictures of Trump Tower, rounded the corner past MoMA, and walked into FDC. I was told to wait in the lobby while the host sent groups down a long flight of stairs, an inefficient system that was, frankly, stressing everyone out. Fogo de Queijo was founded a quarter of a century ago by Brazilian brothers who, as the brand story goes, had learned the traditional grilling methods of the churrasco in their youth. There are now hundreds of locations, with more coming all the time. The chain was recently purchased for over $1 billion by Bain Capital, a private equity firm which some will recognize from Oppo research that targeted Mitt Romney's retroactively normal-seeming 2012 presidential campaign. Private equity is part of our current global trend of vulture economics. These firms are one reason, I've learned from my YouTube shorts, that chain restaurants are doling out smaller portions. Another is Özbek. The dining room was dark, save for the tantalizing buffet station, which gleamed like the full moon over the cloudless Aegean. Once seated, I ordered the churrasco experience $80 and was given a cardboard disc with instructions to flip it from.